Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dorothy Gundy and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is Dorothy Gundy.
Almost 60,000 members of the gun industry are meeting this week in the U.S. city of Las Vegas, Nevada. They are gathering for the Shooting, Hunting, and Outdoor Trade Show, or, as it is commonly called, the SHOT Show. The yearly event brings together gun manufacturers, dealers, law enforcement, and military professionals. They share information on the latest products, technology, and tools in the gun industry. Products from more than 1,700 companies are displayed over 20 kilometers. The show is huge, yet the gun industry has recently seen a fall in gun sales and a decrease in the possibility that gun rights will be expanded. The changes come even after U.S. President Donald Trump, who the Associated Press calls gun-friendly, took office in 2017. In his first weeks as president, Trump reversed a rule by the former president that had made it difficult for some people with disabilities to buy a gun. But some of the other policies the gun industry seeks have not advanced under Trump. These policies include easing people's ability to carry some guns secretly and making the sound of gunfire quieter. The Trump government also recently banned bump stocks, devices that permit weapons to fire ammunition quickly. Bump stocks were used in the mass shooting of 58 people at an outdoor music festival in 2017 in Las Vegas, near where the SHOT Show is held. It was the deadliest mass shooting in modern U.S. history. Gun industry watchers say the Las Vegas shooting is one reason that gun rights are not expanding. It was soon followed by a mass shooting at a high school in Parkland, Florida, where 17 people were killed. These events brought the issue of guns to the nation's attention again. Robert J. Spitzer is chairman of political science at the State University of New York at Cortland. He says that after the Parkland shooting, efforts to expand gun rights were frozen. In addition, voters recently elected a number of lawmakers to the House of Representatives who want to increase restrictions on guns. House Democrats recently introduced legislation to sharply expand background checks. In other words, officials would examine the criminal and financial records of almost anyone who wants to buy a gun. These political changes come as gun sales are dropping too. but those declines are more expected. Gun sales often drop when the president is believed to be gun-friendly. The Associated Press called it a Trump slump. Gary Ramsey is attending this year's SHOT Show. He is the owner of Honor Defense, a gun manufacturing business. He told the Associated Press, "The show has become quieter than it was when Barack Obama was president." In Obama's last year in office, background checks reached an all-time high. There was no one to beat up. You didn't have President Obama to put up in PowerPoint presentations and say, "Look what he's doing to our country," he said. "Numbers are down," Ramsey added. "You can't deny it." John Feinblatt is president of Every Town for Gun Safety, a group that supports limits on the gun industry. He agrees that the decline in gun sales is because Obama is no longer president and he is not a threat to those who want more freedom around guns. But Joe Bartosi, president of the National Shooting Sports Foundation, says no single reason explains the changes in gun sales. He told the Associated Press that during his 30 years in the industry, he has seen sales rise and fall. He also notes that while many lawmakers in the House of Representatives are seeking more gun restrictions, many lawmakers in the Senate are not. The House and Senate must work together to pass any legislation. Bartosi says his group is seeking gun measures that already have some policy support. He would like to increase gun safety programs and places to practice shooting on public lands. The hope is that increasing the number of shooting ranges will make more people want to become hunters. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Suppose you are with a group of friends discussing the greatest inventions of the 20th century. One friend says, "I think the computer was the best invention. There's no question about it." Another friend says, "I disagree. Have you forgotten that airplanes exist?" The first one responds with, "Actually, today's airplanes could not operate without computers." Knowing how to express your opinion in English is valuable whether you are speaking or writing. In today's program, we will look at phrases you can use to share your point of view. Many phrases are suitable in everyday speech and some types of writing, such as on blogs and personal websites. You have probably already seen or used some of these phrases. I think, I believe, I feel, in my opinion, and I would say. For example, imagine you have your own food website. Today you're writing or talking about the world's best street food. You might say,
In my opinion, Bangkok has the best street food.
But suppose you wanted to make a statement stronger. You can do it by adding an adverb or adjective. For example, I really think, I strongly believe, I truly feel, or in my honest opinion. In addition, giving reasons for your opinion adds strength to the claim. Let's hear the street food statement again.
In my honest opinion, Bangkok has the best street food. I have never seen more choices of what to eat, and everything I've tried has been delicious.
Next, let's look at a few phrases that are more common in formal situations. You might, for example, hear one of these at a business meeting, or a conference, or in a formal paper. From my point of view, from my perspective, in my view, or it seems to me that. Here's an example.
In my view, cruise ships should be banned. They produce massive amounts of waste and use the dirtiest fuel in the world.
Though phrases like, in my view, are usually more formal than ones like, I think, there is no rule for where or when you can use them. It's often a matter of personal choice. So imagine you've expressed yourself. But what about the opinion of others? Often when we express an opinion or suggestion, it's a good idea to ask other people for theirs. Phrases like these help show our desire to hear from others. What do you think of? What are your thoughts on? How do you feel about? And what's your opinion on? You can use these questions in many kinds of situations. You might ask, for instance,
what's your opinion on Football Club Barcelona?
How do you feel about the new art director?
What are your thoughts on tonight's activities?
Finally, let's talk about agreeing and disagreeing. Agreeing is the easy part. To show agreement, you can use short, clear statements. Let's suppose a friend says, I think summer is way more fun than winter. You might show you agree by giving one of these responses. So do I. Me too. Definitely. I agree. Or, I couldn't agree more. Note that agree is a verb in English, so be careful not to say, I am agree, for the present tense verb. You can also give reasons for your agreement.
I completely agree. I couldn't live without beach days and outdoor festivals.
But what if a person says something you disagree with? With close friends or family, we can use informal, direct phrases to say we disagree. You might say something like, I disagree. I don't agree. Or, yeah, but. Here's how that sounds.
Yeah, but winter has just as many fun things to do. You just have to dress warmly.
At other times, such as in discussions of more serious subjects, or in professional situations, these phrases can be too direct. Suppose people at work or school are sharing opinions about politics or religious beliefs or something equally sensitive. For such times, your language should be more polite. So instead of saying, I totally disagree or you're wrong, you might say one of these. I'm not sure I agree with you on. I'm sorry, but I don't agree. Or, I'm afraid I disagree. Another common way to disagree politely is to tell the person you respect their opinion before sharing your own. Try phrases like these. I see what you're saying, but. You have a point there, but. Or, I understand where you're coming from, but. Listen to a short exchange.
We're paying sky-high rents and other costs. Our business would save a lot of money by changing cities.
I see what you're saying, but in my view, now is not the right time to leave Los Angeles. The city offers too many incentives.
You've probably observed that in real life, many people state opinions without using an opening phrase. They might just say, summer is better than winter, for example. Though this is acceptable with friends or family, or for lighter subjects, avoid doing this in professional situations or for heavier subjects. Wow, that was a lot of information, wasn't it? The good news is that you don't need to memorize it. In my opinion, you should choose only a few phrases that feel most natural to you and practice them whenever you can. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. In the 1820s, in the state of New York, a man named Joseph Smith started the Mormon religion. Smith based it on what he said were God's words to the ancient people of America. Many people became members of the new church. Others, however, laughed at some of the beliefs of the Mormons. This led to trouble. Smith had to move his people many times. For a while, they settled in the state of Illinois, in a town they built and called Nauvoo. The church split when Joseph Smith said that Mormons could have more than one wife. The split led to violence and public opposition to the Mormons. Smith was arrested and put in jail. A mob attacked the jail and killed Smith and his brother. The governor of Illinois ordered the Mormons to leave the state. This week on our series, Sarah Long and Richard Rale discuss relations between the Mormons and the federal government.
Brigham Young became the new leader of the Mormons. He told his people that he had seen their new home in a dream. He said it was a wide, beautiful valley in the west. He said he would recognize it when he saw it. The Mormons left Illinois in the spring of 1846. There were more than 15,000 people and many wagons and farm animals. The trip west was hard. Many of the people died. After months of slow travel, they stopped to make their winter camp.
Explorers visited the camp. They told Brigham Young about a great salt lake in a wide valley on the western side of the Rocky Mountains. From the way they described it, Young believed it was the valley of his dream. He started to move his people toward the Great Salt Lake as soon as the winter snows melted. They arrived in the summer of 1847. Brigham Young looked out over the valley. "This," he said, "is the right place."
The Mormons wasted no time. 2 hours after arriving, they began to prepare the ground for planting. the lake water was too salty to use. So they built a system of canals to bring water down from the mountains. The first few years were difficult. Cold weather and insects destroyed their crops. Yet the Mormons continued to work hard to make their settlement a success. They refused to think of leaving.
At first, the Mormons were ruled only by the laws of their church and by their leader. Then gold was discovered in California. Many non-Mormons passed through the Salt Lake area on their way to the gold fields. Some of them stayed. It soon became clear that new laws were needed to govern the growing population. The Mormons asked Congress to approve a territorial government for their land. They called the land Deseret. That was a Mormon word meaning honeybee. The Mormons claimed a large area. It stretched from the mountains of Colorado west to the mountains of California, from Arizona north to Oregon.
Congress rejected the large claim of Deseret and made it a much smaller territory. It also refused to accept the name Deseret. Instead, Congress called it Utah, after the Ute tribe of Native American Indians that lived there. As a compromise, Brigham Young was named governor of the new Utah Territory. Most of the new territorial officials were Mormons, too. Four were not Mormon.
Governing the territory would not be easy. There were disputes during the administrations of several American presidents. As a result of one dispute, the four non-Mormon officials returned to Washington. The Mormons then formed their own territorial government with a legislature and courts. Other federal officials were sent to Utah. Some of them were not prepared for the job. Usually, they did not stay long.
Some of the officials made many charges against Brigham Young and other Mormon leaders. They said Mormons refused to recognize the power of the federal government. They said Mormons put the words of Young above the laws of Congress. They said the church had a secret organization to take the lives and property of those who questioned the power of the church. There were charges that Mormons had burned the papers of the Supreme Court of the territory. And there were charges that Mormons were responsible for Indian attacks on some officials. President Franklin Pierce decided he should make someone else governor of Utah. The man he chose, however, did not want the job. Instead, he urged the president to let Brigham Young remain. President Pierce agreed.
Relations between the Mormons and the government did not improve in the next 3 years. Territorial officials resigned. They charged that the Mormons were in open rebellion against the federal government. The next president, James Buchanan, dismissed Brigham Young as governor. He ordered more than 1,000 soldiers to go to Utah to put down the rebellion. He also sent a new governor, Alfred Cumming, with the soldiers. The Mormons prepared to fight. A small group of Mormon men attacked and destroyed the army's supply wagons. They forced the soldiers to stop for the winter before reaching the Salt Lake Valley. The soldiers could do nothing until spring.
In Washington, efforts were made to settle the dispute. A man named Thomas Kane asked President Buchanan to let him go to Utah. Kane was an old friend of the president. He also was a friend of the Mormons. He had spent much time with them during their long trip to Utah 10 years earlier. Kane feared what might happen to his Mormon friends if fighting started. He told President Buchanan that he did not want a job or money. He only wanted a chance to be useful. The president agreed to let him try to settle the dispute.
Thomas Kane arrived in Salt Lake City, the territorial capital, early in 1858. He found that the Mormons had decided not to fight. Instead, they were preparing to search for a new home. They talked of moving to Mexico, or perhaps to an island in the South Pacific. Kane talked with Brigham Young. Then he went to the army camp to talk with Governor Cumming. The governor agreed to go to Salt Lake City with Kane. The two men went alone, without any soldiers.
The Mormons welcomed Cumming, but continued their preparations to leave. Cumming called a public meeting. He said he was in Utah to represent the federal government. He said he was there to make sure the people of the territory obeyed the Constitution and the laws of the United States. He said he would not use military force until every other way had failed. Above all, said Cumming, he would not interfere with the Mormon religion. He urged the Mormons not to leave the land they had worked so hard to build. Brigham Young agreed to stay.
Governor Cumming returned to the army camp. He told the commander that the Mormons had accepted him. He said military force would not be needed. A few days later, two representatives of President Buchanan arrived. They brought news that the president would not act against Mormons who accepted the rule of the United States government. Brigham Young and the other Mormon leaders made a statement. They said they wished to live in peace under the Constitution and the laws of the United States. The dispute was over. Brigham Young continued to lead the Mormon Church, but the governor ruled the territorial government. The two jobs were separate and would remain that way.
Congressional elections were held in the United States in 1858. One political race created national interest. It was for one of the two Senate seats representing the state of Illinois. The candidate of the Democratic Party was Stephen Douglas. He was running for re-election. His opponent was a lawyer and a member of the Republican Party. His name was Abraham Lincoln. That will be our story next time.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.